If you have a favorite Christian worship song, this can be a contemporary song, this can be an old hymn, whatever. What's your favorite?
Holy, holy.
Holy, holy, holy? Okay. A great old hymn. Okay. Anybody else? Got a favorite?
That's actually mine too.
Is it?
I can still remember it was number 11 in my hymnal in church when I was little.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really good. That is really good.
Which one?
Holy, holy, holy.
Well, this one was holy, holy.
Yeah, they were the same. Yeah. Number 11 in the hymnal. So, whose favorite is not holy, holy, holy? I mean, we all like holy, 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 right?
I like the old rugged cross.
You like the old rugged cross? Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah.
Amazing Grace is also great.
Amazing Grace. Yeah, it's very difficult not to like Amazing Grace.
Great is thy faithfulness.
Great is thy faithfulness.
How great thou art.
How great thou art. You know, I have a very vivid memory. I was going to a week of Christian camp for the first time when I was entering fifth grade. And, you know, we'd sleep in those cabins. And, you know, Christian camps now, they're not cabins. It's more like a resort, okay? But these were just simple wooden cabins on a concrete slab. And, you know, we've got bunks that are just built in and mattresses on them and such. And it was pretty cold in the mornings, but they would ring a bell to wake us up, and then they put music on. And typically the music, there was a really kind of a corny recording of How Great Thou Art. But it didn't matter that it was a corny recording of How Great Thou Art, because it was How Great Thou Art. So whenever I hear that song, I think of kind of waking up, you know, and my nose is cold and I'm not sure I want to get out of my sleeping bag, but hearing that song. Well, the reason I mention this is that the text that we're going to be looking at today, Colossians 15 to 23, Colossians 1, 15 to 23, contains a section which is commonly identified as an early Christian worship song or an early Christian hymn. We're used to the word hymn in English. The Greek word in the New Testament, which is translated hymn, we just take the Greek word and transliterate it. It's hymnos, so we just render that into English. But that was a word which was generally used to refer to songs that celebrated a hero. And so you can appreciate how Christians are using that term for the songs that they're using, because they are celebrating a hero, and the hero is Christ.
Well, they probably weren't printed out either.
Oh, heavens no. There was no printing.
What I'm saying is, you had to remember it.
Yeah, exactly. There was nothing. I mean, you could write down the words, but there was also no way to make musical notation that we're aware of. You know, if you learned a tune, you learned it by hearing it. And this would have been true whether it was sung or, say, you know, plucked on a lyre or using other musical instruments that they would have had. Everybody was an ear musician in the ancient world. I couldn't have coped. I've got to have a score, okay? But that's the way it would have been. Now, what I find interesting about this kind of this hymn is. The question, was Paul kind of using something that his readers were already familiar with as he's writing this? Is he saying, effectively, what he's saying in this section is, I want to remind you of who Christ is. So is he reminding them by saying, here's something that we have sung together? And so if you know this, then it will remind you of who Christ is. That's a possibility. The other side of this question is what we read in verses 15 and following fits the point that Paul is making so well. It's hard to believe that he didn't write it for the occasion. But either way, it's written in a poetic style. Okay, in fact, in the Greek New Testament, the edition that I use most commonly, it's written out you know, in poetic lines on the printed page. Now, you would not find an ancient manuscript where they did this, because that wasn't the convention then. In fact, you would not find a really ancient manuscript of the New Testament that had spaces between the words, because they just wrote all the letters without spaces. You know, wouldn't you love to meet the person who invented spaces between the words and just thank that person for all the good that they've done for you in reading? But in the ancient world also, there wasn't silent reading. You didn't pick up a book and read it silently. You might read it by yourself, but you read it out loud to yourself. Okay. So you're looking at the letters and you're making the sounds that the letters signify, and then you're listening to yourself. And that's kind of how you got past the absence of the spaces. So at any rate, we look at this and we say it's very poetic. Yeah, David.
Yeah, in Hebrew poetry, I guess they say the same thing different ways.
Yes, yes.
And what about Greek? Is it this?
Well, and it varies, okay. In Greek poetry, there was often meter and rhyme, okay, especially meter. This morning, I'm eating my yogurt, which is my power-packed breakfast for Sunday mornings, okay? It's light, but it gets me through. That and prayer, okay, but mostly yogurt. There was a book on the table. It was Beginner's Guide to Shakespeare, okay? And I still feel like a beginner there, so I'm kind of looking at it. It's a fun book. It's got drawings in it and that kind of thing. It's talking about blank verse. Which is five poetic feet of iambs, da-da. So da-da, 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 da-da. And you structure something like that, and it doesn't rhyme, and that's called blank verse. It's actually based on Greek poetry, that convention of Shakespearean playwriting. Was actually based on things that had been done in Latin and before that in Greek. So in Greek poetry, there is rhythm and oftentimes there's rhyme. In Hebrew poetry, it's all parallelism. It's all poetry that comes out of the imagery and the building up of parallel phrases. This is more like Hebrew poetry, okay? So in that respect, this is a very intercultural kind of a thing, okay? It's written in Greek, and the vocabulary is drawing very very much from the vocabulary that was current at the time in Greek cultural circles. But it's also drawing from expressions that come out of the Hebrew Bible. Greek words, but you know, that would translate expressions in the Hebrew Bible. And the form is more Hebrew than it is Greek in that that respect. Sorry. Yeah, he was, and he's doing what's familiar to him, you know. But at the same time, I love this because you see this, and it's not dissimilar from what, you know, we try to do to make our experience here a more culturally inclusive kind of a thing. You know, when we sing in languages other than English, just to kind of break out of the singular cultural mindset that we have. And I think there's a lot more that we can continue to do and explore with that. But it's just kind of fun to see this happening in the New Testament as these different cultures are coming together and this is being expressed. But the focus of all of this, the focus of the song, as would be the case in the songs that you mentioned, is on Christ. And specifically on the person of Christ, who this person is, and what this person has done. In that respect, maybe the closest analogy would be Holy, 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 you know, which is talking about the nature of the triune God. Okay. God who exists in three persons.
Wouldn't it be neat if people believe this now?
Sorry?
Wouldn't it be neat if people believe this now?
Well, we do. That's good.
I know, but I was just glancing ahead.
Yeah.
People don't believe that nowadays.
Well, the world has always had its division in that respect.
Well,
Yeah.
People think that they know it all.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at some of the key terms here. Starting in verse 15, I just want to pick out several expressions and talk about what these would have signified. So verse 15, he is the image of the invisible God. The term image is the first term that Paul leads off with. Now, remember how we talked last week about this thing that we label the Colossian heresy, this what we infer is the false teaching that Paul is addressing here. That seems to be offering something which the teacher's purport gives a greater experience of God. And so the first thing that Paul says is that the invisible God is made visible in Christ. Okay? If you want to see God, look at Christ. Now, when I say look at Christ, obviously they couldn't do that literally, but what they can do is listen to and reflect on the story of Jesus. And so in that, we see with our mind's eye who God truly is, and the invisible God becomes visible. Now, there's some other things kind of going on with this. If we say image of God, in a larger context of the Bible, what comes to mind?
Idols.
Well, idols for one, yeah, the people making an image of God.
We're studying, looking at the Old Testament, and they're talking about how they didn't want to follow God. They wanted to have gods like the people around them.
Yeah, idolatry is rampant in the ancient world. Thank goodness that modern people don't have idols. Yeah, absolutely. The idea of humanity in God's image, okay? And that seems to play a role in Paul's selection of this word, too. Now, in the ancient world, and this is tied to the idea, to a certain extent, this is tied to the way that people thought of and understood idols as images of power, okay? But it's also tied to the way that in ancient kingdoms, an image of the king or images of the king would be made and circulated through the whole territory. So when you come to a place and you see an image of the king, that says this king is in charge here. So to say that humanity, the human beings bear the image of God in Genesis is to say that God is expressing his rule over the world in human beings. That we are effectively ruling the world under the rule of God. Okay, that we are given a kind of provisional authority over the world under the authority of God. And of course, what do we do with that? We want to run the show ourselves without God. Okay. So as we think about this, it seems that Paul is kind of deliberately playing on the two different ideas here. One is that Christ reveals who God is, and the second is that in Christ we see the true way that God's authority is exercised in the world by a human being. Okay? Christ is fully divine, but he is also fully human, and as a human, he is expressing the submission to the authority of God the Father, that is the real and true way that humans are called to live in the world as God's image bearers. Okay, how is God's authority going to work itself out in the world? Well, God's plan, God's purpose is that it should work itself out in human beings who are in submission and subjection to God. And Christ is the one who does that. He's the one who does that most fully. You know, if we think about it this way, in the story of Genesis, Adam doesn't have the power of God and refuses to submit to God as a way of grasping that power. Okay, the snake says, if you eat, you will become like God. Okay, and so rather than submitting to God, Adam goes on his own and grasps for the power that he doesn't have. that he wants. Christ has the power of God, yet doesn't use it for his own advantage, and submits to God. Not my will, but yours be done.
There's okay. Someone else who tempted Jesus.
Yes, exactly. If you look at the story of Jesus' temptation, Matthew 4, Luke 4, all of the temptations echo the temptation in the garden, and they all represent ways of turning away from the cross. Command these stones to become bread. Okay, we're dealing with something that you eat, which reminds us of the fruit in the garden. But also, when we look at the story of Jesus, he never uses his divine power for his own advantage. Okay, he uses it to serve others, not to serve himself. And in the end, you know, what is it that people say? You know, he saved others, let him save himself. If you're the Christ, come down from the cross. And he doesn't. Okay. So all of those temptations represent kind of anti-crosses, ways of turning away from the cross. So as we come back to Colossians with image, we really see, you know, this thing. Here God is being fully revealed, and also the image of God in humanity is being fulfilled. This is the way it really functions. This is the way it really looks. What does it mean to be a true human being? It means to be like Jesus. What is the true God like? He's fully revealed in Jesus. Okay. And we're dealing with all of those kinds of things, I think, as we look at this. Then we come on this next expression, the firstborn of all creation. Okay. Now, we've got to read this word in its literary context and in its cultural context. The literary context comes obviously right before and also right after. For by him all things were created. That next phrase in verse 16 helps us understand what firstborn of all creation does and doesn't mean. Okay. First of all, the very idea of the world as divine creation is outside of the traditions of the people of Israel. Basically unknown in the Mediterranean world. Okay, the Greeks don't have a creation story as such. Okay, you know, they have stories about the origins of various things, but there's nothing like in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Nothing like that. The same thing would be true in the ancient Near East. That kind of belief didn't exist. The world simply is. You know, it exists, and the gods play their part in that. But there's no notion of creation of all things. So when you read, by him all things were created, in heaven, on earth, visible, invisible, etc., that is very definitely taking us back to this Israelite understanding as revealed in the scriptures of Israel. God is creator. And because God is creator, God is sovereign over everything. How many gods are there, faithful Israelites? One. Good answer. Okay. All right.
That was a trick question. I thought.
That's why I said faithful Israelites, because some say, well, I don't know. There may be several. Those would be the unfaithful kind. Okay. They don't come to Sunday school at 9 in the morning. They only show up for worship at 10. Oh, that was a terrible thing to say. That was brutal right there. Okay. I shouldn't say that kind of thing, but I will keep doing it. So by saying, by him all things were created, Paul is identifying Jesus unequivocally with Israel's God, with the one true God, okay? He's not saying, I've got something to tell you, there are two gods. No. He's saying, this one God is fully present, fully revealed in Christ, who existed before his incarnation in the world and is the creator. Okay. If we ask ourselves, why do Christians believe this weird Trinitarian thing, that there is one God who exists in three persons? We're driven to it because of the way that the New Testament presents Jesus as having the power, the authority, the nature that belongs only to the one true God. Yet, as the Son, he submits to the Father. Okay? So, how many gods are there? One. Okay. And Jesus is God. That's proposition one. Yet, Jesus submits as the Son to the Father. You know, I have cynical atheist friends. I have cynical Christian friends too, but I have cynical atheist friends who say things like, when Jesus was praying, was he talking to himself? You know, and I said, come on, no. That's a real conversation. Okay? It's a conversation between two persons. And the prayer itself is not just a conversation, but it's an expression of a relationship. Jesus relies on, depends on the Father, and he submits to the Father. Again, not my will, but yours be done. Okay. So that's an interchange between two persons, the same as it would be if you're talking to anyone else in the room. But at the same time, there is one God. Okay. And if we say, well, what is this like? The answer is nothing. God is unlike anything that God has made in creation. And so we can't compare this to anything. It's not like water that exists in three forms. That's not sufficient to explain this, or eggs, expensive as they may be. Tom and I were talking about eggs earlier. Okay. You know, all these analogies that we make. God is unlike anything else, but we're driven to this because of this. One of the most interesting experiences of my life was several years ago. I was invited to be a part of something that a church in Louisville, Kentucky did on a Sunday morning. It's a former student of mine who is the lead pastor at this church, and he had struck up a friendship with the imam from the Islamic Center, the mosque that was, you know, in his part of town. This man's fascinating. He's a refugee from Syria. Had to leave at the beginning of the war. And I think he's lost much of his extended family through the war. At the time that we were together, there was a lot of just unknown things about all of this. But we were there at the church on a Sunday morning to talk about, you know, our respective beliefs and so forth. And it was really interesting and challenging, and I have to say in retrospect, satisfying to be able to talk about, well, why do we regard Jesus as divine, and why do we Christians therefore regard God as triune, which is something that in Islam you just can't do this, can't go there, okay? And to talk about this as coming out of the way that Christ reveals this in the story that we read in the Gospels, okay? That Jesus is acting with divine authority, and there's only one God. There's only one being who can have divine authority. Yet, he obeys the Father. He submits to the Father. He prays to the Father. And those are all real interactions. Okay? One God existing in, well, at this point we're at two. Throw in the Spirit. You've got three. You're good to go. Okay? But we have kind of the breakthrough in our realization when we see the story of Jesus working out. So Paul is really summarizing that here as he says what he's saying in this combination. So he created all things. He is the creator. He is the one true God. Now let's back up to firstborn, okay? Because I hear firstborn of all creation, and it could sound like the first one who is created, you know? He's the first created of many other things. What helps us see that's not the case is the next phrase, okay, which says he created all things. You can't both be created and create all things. Okay, so he is the eternal creator. He is the divine creator, not one step removed from the divine creator. But then why use the word firstborn? Well, this is where we need to think culturally. If you are the firstborn son in an ancient Near Eastern family, what is your status?
You're the heir.
You're the heir. Yeah, you're in control. Yeah, you are the one in charge, in essence. And so that's the idea here. Firstborn is to say primacy. It's to say authority. It's to say rule. Yeah. He is the one who has rule and authority over all creation.
Okay. Preeminent.
I'm sorry?
Preeminent.
Preeminent, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Preeminent is a great word to use there to describe that. Now, notice in verse 16 the way that Paul expands on creation. Through him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. Okay? Now, visible and invisible. Let's, again, in our mind's eye, kind of imagine this teaching that the Colossians have been hearing. They've been hearing, you can have a greater experience of God if you take these steps that we're recommending. And in doing that, you're going to go through kind of a series of angelic encounters. You know, you'll meet various angels along the way. And if you properly submit to them, satisfy them, etc., you can move on in that experience and eventually kind of climb the ladder to where you see God himself. Okay. Now, what did Paul just say? I don't care where you look, in the visible or the invisible world, Christ created it. And if he did, he is firstborn. So he's in charge. So, do you need to go placate a bunch of angels? Nope. You're already good with the guy who's in charge. Okay, you're good with the boss. So, the specific expressions here, this is kind of fun. Thrones, dominions, rulers, authorities. Now, we read those in English, maybe another language into which this is translated. And all of those words suggest power, okay? But specifically, in Paul's cultural context, these are terms that were used by people for what they perceived or guessed to be different classes of spirit beings, different categories, okay? So, you know, we would have, like, a taxonomy of vertebrates, okay? You know, there are fish and there are amphibians and there used to be reptiles. I forget, they've switched that out now, I think. I went to, no? You sure? Because I was at the American Museum of Natural History and they specifically told me don't say reptile anymore. I don't know, maybe it's just there, whatever. Okay, I mean, I think there are still snakes and things, but anyway, we'll call them reptiles. Reptiles, what did I leave? We've got birds and mammals. There we go. Yeah, mammals, like my neighbors. So that's kind of a division. So we might think of these expressions as an ancient attempt to imagine what spirit beings existed and to classify them. And Paul drops these terms in, but notice he's just kind of dismissive. He doesn't say, now you need to get to know these categories, you need to understand what's in each one, you need to know what their characteristics are, what they do, what they don't do, this is going to be useful information for you. No. Why? You know Christ. Christ is in charge. So are there spirit beings? Of course. Do I need to know about them? Not particularly. Okay. Not particularly. Why? Because Christ is Lord over all of those. Okay. And he is bringing the visible and the invisible world into submission to him. And so that's what I need to know. Okay. He is before all things, verse 17. In him all things hold together. So here, Paul is saying, kind of summing up, he is before all things, which is to say they all have their origin in him. He is, he has authority over all of them, and he holds all things together. He is ruling now. The orderliness of the universe, insofar as it is an orderly place, is grounded in him. It is the expression of his rule over everything. So he's not distant. He's not disengaged. He's present. He's close. He's engaged. He's involved in everything that goes on. Then the next move, verse 16, he is the head of the body, the church. Now, that's something, if you're a New Testament reader, just seems like, oh, very, very familiar idea. He's the head of the body of the church, because this is... this. I'm sorry?
I thought you said
16
is 18.
Okay, I'm sorry, yeah. Verse 18. He's the head of the body, the church. My verse numbers are real tiny, and the 8 looked like a 6 to me.
Sorry.
No, that's okay.
I
oh, I know. Yeah, I'm just... There are various things that remind me I'm not getting any younger, and that is one of them. Okay. Because I've always been nearsighted. I've always been able to read the really small type. But even that is going away. Okay, just diminishing day by day. really familiar idea, right? Well, let's think about this. Because this was, in Paul's time, a new idea. Okay. First of all, the word church. Let's kind of unpack that. Of course, this body of believers that Paul was writing to would have identified themselves together as church. But what would that have signified in their time? Well, in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, what we call the Septuagint, the Jewish people translated their scriptures into Greek probably in the latter part of the 200s BC, and just did this kind of gradually and formally. They didn't have translation committees and editing committees and so forth the way that we would today if we were doing a typical translation. but they translated their scriptures into Greek. In Hebrew, there was a word. Normally, I don't pronounce Greek and Hebrew words in public, but I'll make an exception for you because you're like advanced students, okay? There's a Hebrew word, kahal. In English letters, we'd spell it Q-A-H-A-L, which meant assembly. And it was used especially for the assembly of Israel. So, for example, when Joshua gathers the people of Israel between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal and delivers his kind of farewell address in, what is it, Joshua 24-ish. It's in that neighborhood. Okay. That is the kahal of Israel, the assembly of Israel. It's everybody, so to speak. It's God's people. So when you use this term in a Jewish context, you often used it to refer to the sum of God's people. Those who belong to him. Israel assembled is God's people. In early Christianity, the church uses the Greek translation of that word, ekklesia, to refer to themselves. What are they saying? They're saying, we are the Israel of fulfillment. This is now the true people of God, gathered through God's true Son, the true King whom he has appointed, and... This now means that Jews and Gentiles together as believers in Jesus constitute the true people of God. So first of all, there's an identification here. By saying church, we're saying we are God's true people. If we are God's true people, well, we know God. That's an implication of that. But he is the head of the body. Okay, now that implies authority again, right? The head rules over the body. The body serves the head. And that's the way Paul develops this image when he uses it more extensively elsewhere. But notice it also implies a close, organic connection. Okay, there's nothing more closely connected than a head and a body. Okay. If anything happens to my body, my head finds out about it right away, right? There is that close, intimate connection. So, if Christ is the head and we are the body, we already have the kind of close, intimate, direct connection to God that the false teachers say they're offering. Okay, this is the real deal. In other words, as Paul puts this, okay? So he's the head of the body, the church. He's the beginning. Notice that expression again. Takes us back to Genesis. Firstborn again, but this time firstborn of the dead. Now we're for the first time in this discourse talking about the death and resurrection of Jesus. So now what do I understand here? Okay, Jesus died, Jesus arose. He entered fully into our experience as mortal human beings and experienced everything that we experience. In fact, he entered fully into our experience as sinners. He was not himself a sinner, but he received all that comes to those who are, including death. But God raised him from the dead as the firstborn, again, the one who has primacy, the one who has authority over all of those who are being raised from the dead. Okay? Now, we can take this in another direction as well. In a lot of things in the Christian life, there is an already and a not yet. If you came to our overview of the New Testament in the fall, you'll remember what I'm about to do here. And I can't go 2 weeks and not do this, so I've got to do this week, okay? This is kind of a summary of the way we might expect life to go if we're reading the Old Testament scriptures. Okay, what's life right like? Well, right now it's like this. Blah. Okay, this is approximately the thing that they put on bottles of poison things now to keep kids from drinking it, right? Okay, so Mr. Yuck. Right now, life is Mr. Yuck. Why? Well, do I need to explain? Injustice, disease, death, and we're about to head into February, okay? Which is the month that all reminds us this is the real nature of life. But what does God promise? God promises that he is going to overcome that and change all of that. So this is what we're expecting. Based on God's promise, yeah, life is terrible, but that's not because God is terrible. God is going to make life right. He's going to make it good. What does Jesus do? Well, he takes this and shows us what God is actually doing, and it's got a wrinkle to it. Okay. Yes, life is bad. And yes, God is changing it. But there's an already and a not yet to the way he changes it, okay? Jesus dies and rises from the dead, and that means God's new age has come. But you get up on Monday after Easter, and the pagans are still in charge, okay? And the world is still a mess. Does that cancel all of this? No, it means this present age is continuing, while God's new age, if I can use that term, is breaking in. Okay. Now, one expression of this in our experience is resurrection. Okay. When are you raised from the dead? The answer is complicated. On the one hand, we look forward to the future resurrection when Christ returns. The dead are raised, those who are alive join with them. And as Paul says in 1 Thessalonians, so we will be with the Lord forever. Okay. Our final destination is not as disembodied spirits in heaven. It is raised with new bodies, living together in fellowship and harmony in a renewed creation. Okay, all of that, including barbecue. Okay, I'm very confident of the barbecue part, even though I haven't read it in the Bible. There's some things in Isaiah 26 about really good meat at the feast, okay? I look forward to that, okay? Anyway, back to the subject. That's the future part. But what does Paul say about resurrection in Romans 6? We are raised to new life in baptism. When we come to faith and are baptized, as that represents what God is doing in our lives, God is raising us from the dead, okay? A different way to put this is to ask ourselves the question, when did we start living eternally? You know, oh, when we came to faith. Okay, when we became part of the people of God in Christ. So here to say firstborn from the dead, he's saying Christ has already begun the work of resurrection in you. Okay, he is the firstborn from the dead, and he is already in the process of raising you up. So even though, you know, my body is inexorably falling apart and will one day fail, I am being, you know, renewed and strengthened every day through the power of Christ. The kind of thing that Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. So firstborn of the dead, he's raised from the dead, and this just defines us. What does it mean to be part of the body of Christ? It means that we're being given resurrection life all the time, and that will never be interrupted. The end of verse 18, that in everything he might be preeminent, that he might be first. So as we've gone through this, that's kind of the summary of that. And then verse 19, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. This is a really, really interesting expression, I think. The English Standard Version says, in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. But what's interesting is the phrase of God doesn't actually appear in the original language text. It's literally, in him all the fullness was pleased to dwell. And that probably gives us a clue as to what's going on in the background. Okay. Imagine one of these false teachers coming to you, into your community, and saying, oh, you're a Christian, you're a follower of Jesus. That's great. Okay. We're going to give you the fullness. Okay. You're going to have the big deal, the fullness. So this is probably a term which is being picked up, adopted, it's in circulation, and this is now being specifically offered as a thing to the Colossian Christians. If you follow what we tell you, you will have the fullness. And what Paul says is, you already have the fullness. Okay? The fullness of God was in Jesus. And the way to have a greater experience of God is simply to understand and appropriate who Jesus is, what Jesus has done. You know, and to walk in that and to live in that. And that's how we experience God.
This translation says, for it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness to dwell in him.
Yeah. And notice how they've what version is that?
NASB.
NASB. Okay. Yeah. And that's also a perfectly good translation. What they've done is introduce the Father, and again the original language text simply says in him the fullness was pleased to dwell, but the implication is, you know, this is God in all that God is. Okay, God with nothing left out. Okay, God with everything included. What aspect of God's being is not present in Jesus Christ? It's all there. Okay, how can I know God? Know Jesus. What is there to know of God that cannot be known through Jesus? Nothing. You know, which is not to say that we ever exhaust the being of God. Okay, I'm going to chase a rabbit here. Did any of you see the TV show The Good Place? Nobody? Well, then there's absolutely no point in my talking about this. Okay, because no one has seen the show. But I'm going to do it anyway, okay? All right, Good Place is a very amusing program. It's about people who are kind of trapped in life beyond death. They think they're in paradise, but they're really in hell. Okay. And they keep getting like a restart. and on and on and on. Now, I'm going to skip clear to the end. Big spoiler alert here, but I can tell. If you haven't watched the show by now, you're not going to watch it, okay? And I'm not sure that I would recommend that you do. When you come to the end of the show, they finally kind of escaped all of this hellishness and they've entered into a real paradise. And what they discover is that eventually they just kind of get bored with it and they don't want to exist anymore. And so the way that this is set up is that when you decide you're done, you just kind of no longer are, okay? It's like the real ending of The Little Mermaid, okay? In Hans Christian Andersen's story, Little Mermaid becomes seafoam, okay? But Disney can't end that way. That would be a sad ending, okay?
So they just suicide,
well, not really suicide. They just kind of cease to exist. But you like pick your time. So it is like suicide in that respect, I suppose. What's missing in that story is that even though it's about an afterlife and all of this kind of thing, there's no God in the story. You know, there's and so there is no infinitely inexhaustible being to know and to love. Okay. So experience is finite. There are only so many things that you can experience and so many times that you want to experience them. And when you're done, you're done. Okay? But what if there is an infinitely inexhaustible God? Okay? Who can be known truly now and be known more completely as time goes on to eternity? It's not boring. You know, and we might think, I am pretty sure I would get tired of that. I am pretty sure I would get tired of that. But it's not about me. It's about God. Okay? So there's something very, very kind of challenging about this idea of the fullness of God. Okay, and then verse 20, I'd hope to get a little bit further, but we'll say something maybe about verses 21 to 23 next week. Through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. So the work of Christ is to take the world back, okay? And as we think about this kind of going full circle, he made all things and now he is reconciling all things. The story of the Bible is not the story of a God who creates the world and then abandons it. It is the story of a God who creates the world and who takes it back as human beings, go into rebellion. So unpack all of this. Life is different. Life is different in all and every respect. And, We'll continue to see how that works out. Let's stop there. Okay? Thanks, you guys. I yammered on pretty endlessly today, but I appreciate your staying awake through the whole thing. And hope you can come back.